Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce, the podcast series that explores the fascinating and often overlooked history of fresh fruits and vegetables. Here are your hosts, Patrick Kelly and John Parr.
As she walked the plank up to climb aboard the magnificent Titanic, 26-year-old Sylvia Cadwell, a pretty missionary, on one of the last wearisome legs of her journey home after nearly 3 years in Siam, quizzed a crew member who was loading luggage. "Is it safe?" she asked him. "God himself couldn't sink this ship," he replied. But it would only be a matter of time before Sylvia's adoring husband, Albert, who would describe how he watched the majestic steamer as the sea swallowed her up whole in the darkness of the night. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce. And that, Patrick, were the first lines in the book, The Last Night on the Titanic, Unsinkable Drinking, Dining, and Style by Veronica Hinkey, who also happens to be our guest today. And as you can probably figure out from that passage I read and the book title, today we will be talking about the legendary RMS Titanic. Very exciting.
I am excited to be here, man. Like I told you many times as we're talking about these subjects, it's like I get more calls, you know, saying, "Hey, I'm following the history of Hawaii," or, you know, "Gosh, you guys really damaged those words when you're trying to pronounce them."
Yeah, no challenging words today, I don't think.
You know, but in all honesty, though, it's definitely making us think a little bit more. We're going outside the box. I mean, these are things like, you know, when my wife was listening to the history of Hawaii, she was just like, "You guys didn't practice these words beforehand?" I go, we just kind of went all out with it. And again, this is another fun one. You know, I've got the book right here, that Titanic, the official cookbook. And this is what we're going to talk about. I think, you know, everybody knows this is a fresh produce podcast, right, John? So what do you think we're going to talk about on this lovely Titanic episode, right? And, you know, we might even go over where what period where you're in, what they're going to eat at sea, you know, all of the things that you're wondering about food, I think we're going to talk about, right, John?
Absolutely. It's a story we all know, but through a very unique lens, which makes, I think, this whole show very unique and exciting to see history through a completely different lens that you don't generally look through.
Yeah, I totally agree. And like I said, our guest for today, she's amazing. She's ready to talk to, you know, one of the hardest things to do, John, and you know this, is when we get people on the line, they're like, "What are we talking about?" She knows what's in her book. She's passionate about the food. She already kind of went over with us in the green room what she wants to go over first. And that's what I love. You know, when you got passion towards it, we're ready, because, you know, John, you and I both have passion for produce.
Absolutely.
What do you think? You want to get our guest on?
Of course. I think we've kept her waiting enough.
Yeah, I think we did. So
time
let's
to board.
Go ahead and welcome Veronica to the show. Veronica, happy to have you.
Hi, happy to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you.
Oh, we appreciate it.
So, Veronica, we're going to dive right into it, because we have quite the story to get through here. And we want to start, I think, with setting the stage of what this period looked like. So we know that the Titanic was in the period of the early 1900s. And it was a significant period. It was before a lot of big world events that had impacts on every level, including the culinary level. So during the period of the Titanic, which is labeled the Edwardian period, what did that look like from a culinary standpoint? What defined the Edwardian period in the terms of culinary etiquette and style?
Well, one of the great lessons from the incredible story of the Titanic is the culinary style of the Edwardian years. It was 1912. It was April 15th, 1912, when the Titanic sunk. And we are so fortunate to have some of the menus that were either in people's pockets that they tucked away with them and got into lifeboats with, or letters that people wrote home. The food was so magnificent aboard the Titanic that people actually wrote letters home, like to their wives and loved ones, talking about things like the lunch that Adolphus Cellfield wrote about to his wife Gertrude and the things that he ate. So we can see that there were signs of the Edwardian era, 11 course dinners in first class that began with fancy hors d'oeuvres, oysters. There was a huge French influence. You can see signs of Auguste Escoffier style, throughout in menus. The consommés that each dinner started with after the hors d'oeuvres and the fabulous desserts all the way through to the desserts. Really unique things like chartreuse jelly was one of the desserts with peaches in first class on the last night. And where do you see chartreuse anymore? And it's sort of one of those things that is one of those things that sort of went away with prohibition a few years after the Titanic, within that, within a very short time span, prohibition began. And a lot of these liqueurs slipped through the cracks of time, and we didn't see them for many years. We're starting to see more and more of them now in the cocktails as well that were popular. But really, just in short, the Titanic was the time capsule that really encapsulated all those amazing features of that era that is truly bygone.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned how the courses, I mean, it was incredible, the amount of food that people were consuming, specifically the elite, of course, like you said, these multi-course meals, and just the showiness of it all, because I understand that obviously the Edwardian period was named after King Edward, after Victoria passed away and left the crown to him. And he was obviously a gentleman of deep passion of eating, and kind of inspired this whole era of the multi-courses and just really transformed the idea of dining. I mean, I think we see that obviously in the blockbuster movie Titanic, just the showiness of it all. And it was also during this period where there was this custom of now dining out to be seen and to see and be seen, really. You didn't have that prior in the Victorian period. It was really transformative. And like you said, I think that the Titanic acted as a time capsule to capture that level of showiness to dining. And one thing you also touched on was the French craze or the French passion of cuisine at this period. What was it with the elite classes of this period that kind of had them inspired and wanting French cuisine in particular? Was there a reason for that?
Well, it was very much like what we experience today, the things that we're exposed to in our travels, and the chefs, like at that time, Escoffier, the people that we see the most and hear about the most, those are the people that we want to experience their foods the most. And, we want to try the foods of different travel destinations. I also think we should mention that along with the fabulous first course, first class meals, and second class wasn't much, it was not far behind, by the way. One of the huge distinctions of the Edwardian era in culinary was the class distinctions that really dissolved through World War I. When World War I happened, several years after the Titanic, because of the need for people to be involved in the war effort and so forth, we never saw those class divides again, quite like we did aboard the Titanic. And a few years after, we see in the menus that there was a separate menu for second class and for third class. And there are really huge differences, disparities in the menus of courts. We don't really see that so much anymore. Third class was still much more elegant than, or wouldn't use the word elegant. Let me backpedal on that. I would say third class was still much more substantial than other ships at the time, but it was still nothing like second or first class. And in third class, we see that their menu for the whole day is printed on one menu versus multiple menus for each day in other classes. What's really key is that dinner is a kind of a snacky dinner, you know, whereas when first class passengers were eating these incredible, long-winded dinners, there would just be snacks, because the main meal in third class, which was called dinner, was in the middle of the day, the noon meal. And that's when they had things like roast beef with brown gravy. And something that good wouldn't have been experienced at any other of the other meals of the day. So those class divides, which we see, you know, in the Titanic movie, so well portrayed, it really did a great, the movie did a great job of showing that. That's something else that really is distinct to the Edwardian drinking and dining.
You know what I love too is when you look at the Edwardian period, you know, John and Veronica, you know, I always think of, you know, going back to, you know, King Edward the VII, and, you know, think about realistically like the luxurious dining, John, that, you know, you could think about, you know, showing up to dinner with your white gloves on, and, you know, everybody was dressing up a lot too. I mean, especially on the Titanic too. There was a lot of influence, and you said it too, Veronica, which was, and this a couple of things that I grabbed too, the tea culture. There was tea time on the Titanic. We know that there was plenty of that. There was a large influence of ingredients that were brought on. And John, this also goes back to when we think about and talk about fresh produce, which is like, what were those ingredients that were put on, right? What was that culinary aspect in the Edwardian period? And I think, like, you know, Veronica, you said it, you know, like you saw in the movie, you know, was it fact or fiction, right, John? We had this too, like, what was on the boat was clearly what was on the boat in the early 1900s, and the menu really shows that too.
It really does. And another great example of where James Cameron really did his homework, I mean, it was spot on. And the best example is the spring ingredients, including spring lamb, the mint sauce. And we see that, you know, really iconic scene of Cal ordering for Rose, and he orders the lamb with mint sauce. And that was one thing that was so unique. Probably not the word unique, I wouldn't say that, but one thing that was really prevalent aboard the Titanic, the spring ingredients. There were new potatoes, there were, you know, beautiful spring peas, and different mint ingredients, or mint, a better way to say that would be, you know, mint sauce with lamb. There were things that you might not see at other times of the year that they made sure were aboard the Titanic, and really helped create these fabulous spring menus that we see.
Right. And I think that leads into, you know, what made it such a unique dining experience compared to the ships before it. I mean, if you look at that, you know, John and I were talking about other ships that embarked, and that, you know, the third class would have to bring their own food. I mean, this is one ship, you know, this time around that they allowed everybody to eat on board. Obviously, everybody had different items of what they did. But what made the Titanic, from a dining perspective, so unique for this time, and I believe you talked about it so already a little bit, but, you know, for our listeners, if you were getting ready to tell them, hey, join the Titanic, and they didn't know it was sinking, right? You know, what would be that dining perspective that you could give them if you were telling them this is what you're going to receive on the boat?
Well, one thing that is remarkable is the thought that the chefs put into their menus. And we see that in an example of a crew menu for the sea trials. When Titanic went out for her sea trials, the crew, of course, needed to eat during the day. And the lunch that the officers had plover prominently on it. And it was because of that special thought that the chef had put into a seabird, putting a seabird on the menu that, you know, would be food that the crew would eat. And these are people who had dedicated their lives to working on the sea. So just being really thoughtful of things like that was really evident in the menus. You know, we also learn a lot about the menus, about the history of produce and how things were popular then that weren't so popular years ago, but are coming around again, like rhubarb. That was another item that was on a crew menu. And, you know, seeing those things, we can see that the chefs really put a lot of thought into what they were doing.
Yeah, what's amazing too is that the army of cooks and chefs that were on this ship, I mean, they were cooking 2,000 meals a day. And I was reading, might have been your book or another book, that there was just, you know, it wasn't like there was one chef or two chef or three chef, but there was vegetable cooks and there were sauce cooks and roast cooks and bakers. And I mean, there was basically a specialist for every kind of food on board this. And like you said, it was so intentional with the seasonality of the produce, you know, if we're looking at produce specifically, of what was on those menus. And you sort of touched on this, is that the menus, you know, third class would get one single menu, but each other class, the first and second, would get multiple menus a day. How were those menus decided day to day? Was that something that the chef or the chefs and the cooks on board planned in advance? Was it more day to day, kind of figuring out what they wanted to do, and how did they generate these menus on board? I guess related, were these pre-printed or were they doing this all on the ship?
The menus were printed on the ship. And I think to answer your question about how the planning happened, I don't know of anything written down about this, but I can almost guarantee that there were probably meetings in advance to plan, you know, just like there would be today. Well, gee, what should we make sure we have on board? Plenty of asparagus, because it's going to be April. So we know we want asparagus, lots of potatoes. And then just like we would do today, working each day before to plan, you know, what we are going to have on the table. But I think a lot of preliminary work went in first to know what kind of food to have on board, because, you know, this would have been a full week journey. So there need to be, enough food on board to make those menus happen. And one of the things, you know, when I knew that we were going to talk produce, I looked over all the menus and I looked for things that are repeated the most. And I mentioned a few already because of the seasonality, but potatoes were a huge ingredient. And they were, you know, just like today, just in every which way. There were potatoes for lunch in first class, could be mashed, fried, or baked in their jackets. There were jacket potatoes for breakfast in third class. That was a very popular custom, to have jacket potatoes. Of course, lots of Irish passengers in third class, so that makes sense. And then there were all sorts of fancier potatoes for dinner. You know, there were chateau potatoes and so forth. Apples also were predominant on the menus. There was applesauce with roast duckling that was part of the last dinner in first class. There were baked apples in a couple of different menus. And there were also fancier apple desserts, like apple meringue for lunch in first class. And then, of course, in the plum puddings and those wonderful English puddings, there would have been apples in those as well. So I would say apples and potatoes, there were a lot of those on board.
Yeah, and I could see that the provisions, what included, so the meals that were included in the ticket price were, you know, nearly for all the passengers, right, Veronica? With the exception of the passengers that, you know, were first class and had the a la carte. But it says there was enough food to cater 2,200 people on what should have been this week long voyage. So let's look at some of those. Let's talk about those. So some of these hefty provisions included 75,000 pounds of meat, 11,000 pounds of fresh fish, 40,000 pounds of potatoes, 40,000 eggs, 7,000 heads of lettuce, 1,000 pounds of grapes, 180 boxes of oranges, which normally oranges back then, you know, John, if you recall, they were between 20 and 35 pounds, 50 boxes of lemons, 50 boxes of grapefruit, 800 bundles of asparagus, 10,000 pounds of sugars, 250 barrels of flour, 36,000 apples, 1,500 gallons of milk, and of course, let's not forget, 15,000 bottles of ale. I mean, sounds like a party. I mean, 2,200 people, still a lot to feed, but definitely had its fresh produce items on the boat for sure.
Right, and when you mentioned things like the citrus, for example, it was such a luxury then because it wasn't at all like we can go to the grocery store today and, you know, pick up a few oranges or lemons. It was a really unusual treat back then.
I agree. It still is an unusual treat when you get one around Christmas time in your stocking, right, John?
Oh, yeah. Well, that tradition still sort of lives on some people's households. But so let's see where we are in our story. So it's April 10th, 1912, about 9:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Passengers are boarding the ship. Then at noon, the Titanic leaves the dock at Southampton for its maiden voyage. Maybe not everybody knows this, but it actually makes a stop first in Cherbourg, France, where it arrives around 6:30 in the evening. And then it leaves again at 8:10 heading to Queenstown, Ireland, now known as Cobh. And it is carrying 2,229 passengers and crew. So this is where we are right now. We're on our way to Ireland. And now we have our full passenger list. Now we have, like Veronica, you mentioned, we have a first class passengers, we have second class passengers, third class passengers. What we haven't really painted for our listeners perhaps yet is who made up these classes exactly. What did the stereotypical first class person look like? What did the second class person look like? What did the third class person look like? I think it's important for us to hear what those people's lives were like, and in turn, what kind of food these class of people were used to consuming and how that translated to their experience on the Titanic.
You know, when you start looking at who was on board, which is really what every food story is about, is the people and who was eating the food. It's automatic to start turning to the theme, the great theme in the story. Again, one that James Cameron was really focused on, and that's the immigrant story. And the demographics in third class and second class of the immigrants is profound. In one of the really unusual facts about Titanic is that there were so many different nationalities. There were, you know, over a dozen different nationalities in those classes. There were a few immigrants in first class as well, but not nearly as many. And of course, there was second or third, and there were, of course, most of them were in third class. There were about 113 Swedish passengers in third class, and six in second class. That might be a surprise to some people. Of course, the Chinese passengers who were recently featured in the movie The Six, there were eight in third class. There were eight Turkish passengers. Excuse me. There were Greek, Swiss, Italian, like we see in the movie with the traveling companion of Jack Dawson, Fabrizio. That's such a great story. There was an Australian. There was someone from South Africa, Portugal, Switzerland, Germany, Canada. There were 14 people from France in second class and 5 in third class. Bulgarian, Russian, there were 27 Russians. 44 people from Austro-Hungarian. Those were all the numbers I just gave were third class. And the list goes on. So we definitely see a mix of cultures, and everyone of those individuals from different countries. Most of them were coming to America for the first time. The overwhelming majority of those that were on board the Titanic were coming with hopes in their hearts of starting a new life. This was around the time when pizza was first introduced to America, and it was one of the first places where you could get a slice of pizza was in New York City at a restaurant that's actually still there, Lombardi's. So it really is an interesting example of how culinary was changing, food was changing. You know, you imagine a world where there was no pizza. And around the time the Titanic sailed, we were only just starting to experience pizza here in this country. And it was because of the many immigrants that were coming in from all these different places. Now, in third class, you would see people that were used to traveling for a whole week, like you mentioned, with their own food. Now, aboard the Titanic, they were able to not only eat on board, but they had a dedicated space, a dining area, that actually had windows that they could look out while they were eating. They would be sharing sleeping accommodations, so there were hooks along the wall where they would hang their coats while they ate, because they wouldn't want to leave them in their room. It wasn't like they had a safe, and they had a roommate or roommates in many cases. So, it was a very different lifestyle than the ones in first class. Imagine the different types of experiences people had without their own bathroom, for example, like we would have today in any class. You'd have something that where you'd be able to take a shower, no doubt, on a journey like this. So again, very different class distinctions, and just a wide variety of people, different languages, and different customs.
Well, speaking of the classes, let's ask the next question, which I'm dying to know, because we saw it in the movie, but could it have happened? So, you come in and you think, okay, I'm in first class, or I'm in middle class, or I'm in third class. And normally when you're at the back of the plane, you always know you can't go past the skirt in the front because they're going to stop you, right? But right. Now let's look at, did coach or second class ever interact with first class, or vice versa? And could third class be invited to first class dinner? I mean, were they able to share in meals if invited or if wanting to go? Because like a first class on some areas, like a train or a plane, you could kind of go back all the way to coach, go back and forth. You can kind of do what you want, but it's normally the other classes that are not allowed to. So what was the situation like that between classes eating together or even seeing each other?
Well, that's a good question. And it addresses this point again about the class divides that were so much more distinct than they will ever be again, probably, ever since the First World War. And what I think it would boil down to is there would be a social expectation that, people wouldn't want to be seen talking to someone. It would be very, it would not work in their favor for the most part. And it would be more than, you or I have ever experienced in our lives where you just wouldn't want to talk to someone because of the social class. Whether or not there was intermingling, there very well could have been, certainly between first and second class. In fact, I believe there was some mixing in between first and second class during the hymn service on the evening of the 14th of April. And I believe there were some first class passengers involved in that as well as second. But it would really be not in your favor to be interacting outside of your class.
How dare us? How dare us want to have dinner in first class when we're in third class, right? How dare it? No, I get it though. I mean, and remember, what's funny is I even see this on planes. is that, you know, a lot of people from, you know, coach will try to come through first class and use the restroom. And I see it sometimes that I do when I do fly first class, they'll tell them, hey, you know, that bathroom is back there for you. This bathroom is up here. And sometimes, like, I don't really care, right? But on another side, it's like you are paying the price of that admission to get a meal on the plane. So you don't have to go and spend extra money when you get off. You are getting a bigger seat. So, you know, in retrospect, I totally understand what you're saying, because if you paid that price, then you deserve to be in that class and to get all of those things from that class, right? So I think
right.
That's just, you know, I think that's just one of the funny things. And, you know, and then you also look at like a funny story, like a first class passenger, you know, was given grape scissors to remove grapes from the stem, but second class, you know, class passengers, you know, pulled off the grapes by hand. So it's like, it's kind of funny, you know, two different things, two different ways, but, you know, different tools came with the classes.
Yes. Yeah. A really good example recently, a story was told on Instagram. Someone remembered that in 1968, she was, or 1964, maybe it was sometime in the 60s, she was traveling home from Rome as a teenage girl. She was supposed to be in coach on the airplane. And the flight attendants upgraded her to first class because she was traveling alone. They knew she was a young girl alone. She got seated next to Babe Paley. And she posted about this weekend because of everyone has been interested in watching the new series about Babe Paley and Truman Capote. And I guess that's a good example of something that would never have happened aboard the Titanic.
Makes sense. John, what are you thinking on all this?
No, I mean, it just shows you the impact of classes during this period, not only on, like Veronica was saying, engaging of people, but also in dining and that whole experience. And like you touched on with the different ways of tackling a food could drastically be different between classes. But I think this is a great place to take a break. We're full steam ahead now. We're going into the Atlantic on board the Titanic. It's the evening of April 14th, 1912. And when we get back, we're going to see what's on the dinner menu for our evening. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
JGLC, the place to be, a third-generation, family-owned and operated asset-based company. Throughout their 60 years in business, integrity, reliability, and loyalty to their customers has remained their top priority. JGLC guarantees 24/7 communication with your personal logistics coordinator. They offer competitive pricing without sacrificing services. They operate throughout the United States and Canada. JGLC's customers count on them for dependability and dedication carried out on every order, every time. 60 years of service for all your trucking needs. Visit them at jglc.com for your custom quote.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. If you are just joining us, we are now on board the Titanic. It's the last night of the Titanic, April 14th, 1912. And alongside me, I got Patrick and Veronica, and we're about to sit down for our last meal on board the Titanic. And Veronica, you are the expert here. So we're going to let you guide us on what's on these different menus, depending on what class we're going to be in, for our last meal on board.
Our
last supper aboard.
Well, technically, if we were in third class, our last supper would have been at noon. So we were starving when things got really into the thickness. Right, John?
That's true.
Goodness. Yeah.
So, Veronica, what would we be seeing, again, from a produce lens? What kind of produce items would be featured on our menu if we were in the first class area of the ship?
Well, in first class, you know, this is probably one of the most celebrated, if not the most celebrated, menus of all time. People love to recreate this for special gatherings honoring the tragedy and honoring the people who were part of this great story in history. And they have, you know, In many cases, they have all 11 courses, and there are adaptations. I like to stay true to form. And the one thing that I love to point out about is the salmon with mousseline sauce, which was served right after the consommé courses. There was consommé Olga and cream barley that you could pick from one or the other. And then after that, there was the salmon with mousseline sauce. And that's very similar to hollandaise sauce, but hollandaise sauce is a little bit creamier in my experience. Then there were several different options of entrees, meat entrees. There was chicken lyonnaise, vegetable marrow farsi, which was a vegetarian option. So even back then, I found that interesting that even in 1912, people were offered a vegetarian option. There was lamb with mint sauce. There was roast duckling with applesauce, which I mentioned earlier, and sirloin of beef with the chateau potatoes that I mentioned earlier. And then for the vegetables, there were green peas, creamed carrots, and for a starch, boiled rice. There was also, for a starch, also produce, there were boiled new potatoes. And what's interesting there is the word new, because this was springtime and the emphasis was truly on spring seasonal foods. And then there was a course that was, people love to celebrate this. It was a palate cleanser to clean the palate before moving on to the next courses. There was a punch that was a lemony sorbet type of punch. It wasn't a punch like you drink out of a punch cup from a punch bowl. It was more of a, almost like a frozen ice or lemon ice type of a palate cleanser. And it was delicious and refreshing and just really was like a nice in between the courses to refresh. And like I said, a lot of people love to recreate that for their gatherings and when they entertain, you know, Titanic entertaining and Edwardian entertaining. There was asparagus with vinaigrette, foie gras. There was celery. In Edwardian years, there would have been a serving dish on every fancy table that would be dedicated to celery. And it was called a celery dish. So no doubt that was there on the tables on the Titanic on that last night. And then for desserts, there was a Waldorf pudding, very similar to the Waldorf salad that was popular at the time, which was created at John Jacob Astor IV's Waldorf Astoria Hotel. He was aboard the Titanic. He did not survive. And at his hotel, there was a really fashionable salad with apples and walnuts called the Waldorf salad. And so the Waldorf pudding was similar to that. There was peaches in chartreuse jelly, and that is such a lovely, light, refreshing dessert to make with, you can use fresh peaches or you can get canned peaches. They're just as delicious with this. What's really neat about it is the chartreuse that is used to make the jelly is so hard to come by these days. It's really unusual and it's very expensive if you order it online. I know because I always like to have a bottle of it on hand to make the jelly that goes with the peaches in this dessert. It's made by Chartreusean monks in France, and it is made with all sorts of different botanicals and herbs, and it's just delicious and a beautiful color green. So that was one of the desserts. There were chocolate and vanilla eclairs. There's a nice example of the Auguste Escoffier influence. And then for dessert, there was also French ice cream. And I point out that it's French because American ice cream is on other menus, and it's a little different than the French ice cream that we see on the first class menu, because the French ice cream has eggs. So it's a much richer, creamier ice cream that it makes. So that's probably what I just went over, probably the most celebrated menu of all time.
Yeah, it's a fascinating lineup of foods. I mean, I think our listeners have to put their mindset in 1912 here. I mean, a lot of this might seem, you know, all right, they had asparagus, all right, they had celery, but these were completely elite level produce at this time. I mean, this was not in season produce, and for that reason, if you could get your hands on that sort of produce, that was a big deal. So, you know, peaches, like I said, celery, asparagus, these were fascinatingly privileged produce to be dining on in the first class. So I think we have our mouths watering now with first class. Unfortunately, I think it's only going to go like somewhat downhill from here, right? not too many puns intended here, but second class now.
It's going down, John? Is that what you're How dare. That is no time for joking, buddy. But I'll give you one pass on that one.
But what's Veronica, what is second class looking like? Obviously, I have to imagine it's not going to be as robust as the first class menu, but I imagine there's still some special things in that menu.
Oh, there sure are. In fact, I hate to be a produce nerd, but I'm going to be one here because I get just as excited about the second and third class menus, to tell you the truth, because they just really are, you know, telling of the culture and the different tastes of the time. And of, I love the word you used earlier, intention of the chefs. The last dinner in second class included roast turkey and cranberry sauce. Now, why do you think that is? Roast turkey and cranberry sauce.
It was close to Thanksgiving.
Well, that's a great guess, and you're close to spot on. It actually was not close to Thanksgiving. It might not even have been close to when they were planning it, but it gives you an insight as to how the chefs planned the meals based on what Americans might like. Let's give them a little bit of, let's show them a little bit of love and an appreciation of their cuisine. So, you know, nothing says an American meal more than roast turkey and cranberry sauce. So that was one of the main entrees. And also, they also had spring lamb with mint sauce, just like they did in first class, which was really another great strategy of, you know, bringing in those spring ingredients again. And there was also curried chicken and rice. And I'm sure it was delicious. There were green peas and there was boiled rice. There were boiled and roasted potatoes. And then there was something that I absolutely love, and I see it so much on the Titanic menus, turnips. And turnips are so, I love them so much. I love the colors, the bright, vibrant lavender hues that you'd never see it on a man-made color wheel. It's just so natural and beautiful. And of course, neeps and tatties, which is a really special Scottish tradition of mixing turnips into mashed potatoes. These were turnips again, pureed, and it's just a lovely dish. I've got a recipe for that in my new cookbook, Titanic, the Official Cookbook, because I love turnips. They're just so sweet and tender, and when they're mashed, they're really delicious. And then there was plum pudding. We talked about that a little bit. There was wine jelly. I love to see all the different jellies that are made with different berries and wine, and of course the mint, chartreuse, and so forth. There was a dessert called a coconut sandwich, which was probably a coconut cookie with some filling, either a frosting or something else in between, is what I would guess that would be. And then American ice cream. So there's a little bit of a 1-2, hey, you're in second class, you get American ice cream, not the French in first. Assorted nuts, fresh fruit, cheese biscuits and coffee. And then there was also, I want to back up a little bit. I glanced over the, didn't mention enough about the fish. There was fish on board as well, as you mentioned, when you rattled off that impressive list, like you did with all the different pounds of different things. There was lots of fish. Baked haddock with a little bit of sharp sauce. And I made sure to include a recipe for that in the cookbook as well. And then tapioca and consommé is how they started that meal. So I don't know, not too shabby yet. What do you guys think of that?
That doesn't sound too shabby to me. I'd be satisfied in second class.
I'd be okay with second
I
class.
think so.
I'm
I'm
a
not
second
sure.
class citizen. I'll take it. No, listen, I might take third class. It depends on how much fruit and vegetables they're pumping out in there, you know. But I do need dinner, though. I don't like 12 o'clock dinners. But I'll let Veronica talk more to that.
Yeah, I'm curious now. Now that we've kind of gotten the picture of first and second, I'm kind of dreading what third class is going to be,
Right.
but. What, like you said, Veronica, there wasn't an, I mean, official dinner was around noon, but what was this supper and tea, meal looking like for the third class on the last night?
Yeah, so this is definitely a menu you'd want to try, and you'd want to maybe even think about having a special gathering and serving some of these things to honor this menu because it's pretty interesting. So for breakfast, the third class passengers could have, as I share this, think about how up until the Titanic, they'd have to bring their own food for the full week for an entire family. So now they're in a beautiful, by other ship standards, a beautiful dining area with windows, and they're eating for breakfast. There was oatmeal, porridge, and milk, smoked herrings. That was amazing for that time. The jack of potatoes that I mentioned earlier, ham and eggs, fresh bread and butter with marmalade, Swedish bread was an option, and tea and coffee. And that was a pretty good hearty breakfast. Now, lunchtime for dinner, they started out with a rice soup, fresh bread, roast beef and brown gravy. I mentioned that earlier. Cabin biscuits, sweet corn, boiled potatoes, and then plum pudding with sweet sauce. This is definitely not a bring your own ticket here for this was pretty good. And fruit. There actually was fruit for them. At high tea time, afternoon tea, this would be before supper, there were cold meats and cheeses, pickles, fresh bread and butter. And I couldn't wait to share this with you, the stewed figs and rice. Figs were so popular. And of course, the land of figgy pudding, is, many of these people were from that area. So figs were huge. Now for supper, just a light little something to hold you over. There was cabin biscuits, cheese, and here's probably the most interesting item of all the menus. They were served gruel, which was a watered down porridge, real watery, but it was enough to hold you over.
Okay, that's they did get some fruit, so that's not bad. That's not bad. So certainly a far cry from the first class spread, but all right, not too
But
bad.
not bad, manageable. I mean, listen, if I was going to the Titanic for the first time, I mean, my thing is being downstairs, like in a submarine. That would be my biggest fear. It wouldn't be so much of what the food is. It'd be more of where my quarters were, right?
That's true.
Now, for the first time, I saw something on a menu from the Titanic that I had not seen before, just this past in 2023. A new menu was discovered, and it was from April 11th, and it was the first class menu, and I believe it was dinner. I'm not sure, but it right off the bat, but it had a produce, an item of produce on it that I thought was very interesting, apricots.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, because apricots, I don't think that would be in season. Yeah, well, it could have been in season or very early on. I'm not as familiar with the UK agricultural timeline there, but that definitely is in line with the peaches the same group of fruits. So definitely an elite delicacy, I would imagine, at that point. So that ties. But let's move forward with our story here. So we're April 14th. We just finished our dinners amongst all the classes. It's 11:40 p.m. We have ship lookout Frederick Fleet. He spots an iceberg directly in the path of the Titanic. First officer, Lieutenant Murdoch, orders a hard starboard turn, but the Titanic's right side scrapes the iceberg. And we all know where this starts to head now. So, what I would love to hear, Veronica, are some stories of the passengers on board during this what I can imagine is a chaotic, confusing, panicky time. And perhaps some stories tied to food and, if there are any, fresh produce. What do we know about some of these passengers and what they were going through and their interaction with the foods and produce at this period of the story?
Well, do you want to hear my favorite culinary story of all of them?
Absolutely,
I'm not gonna
right?
say to I'm not gonna say
Yeah.
no to
N no, we
that.
don't. Like, of course we do.
All right. So one of the people who I am the most inspired by from all the research that I did is Charles Jochen, the head baker. And Charles Jochen, his story is one of survival and in true tenacity and in hope. Charles was assigned to Lifeboat 10, technically. However, he was never able to board that lifeboat. He was going to be manning it as crew. There were crew members would get in the lifeboats, including the people like Charles, culinary staff, and they would be in the lifeboats to assist those who were in the passengers by rowing, in coordinating and so forth. On the Thursday before the Titanic struck the iceberg, this would have been 3 days before that Sunday night, he noted on the chart hanging up in the wall where he was working, he noted his lifeboat assignment. It was number 10. However, after he loaded lifeboat 10, he assisted with getting people to get into the lifeboat, and it went out with very few people. I shouldn't say very few, but it was not filled to capacity. At that point, very early on, people did not think it was necessary to get in the lifeboats. It was still hadn't sunk in that they needed to get in. So this lifeboat went out with seats available, but still, Charles was not given the command from the commanders who were helping to board the lifeboat to for him to get in. So he said at that point, he went back down to his cabin to, as he put it, have a nip. Now, the world has seen Charles' story played out on the big screen, holding a flask, hanging on to the poop deck as it's being rushed by mostly third-class passengers trying to get to the top of the poop deck as it's rising up into the sky. And we see that and in the in James Cameron's movie where he's hanging on to a flask in his baker uniform, his baker outfit. But what everyone has always thought is that he was drinking Scotch whiskey. However, I was able to find out through his great niece that it was actually schnapps. Here's the produce connection. It was actually schnapps. He told her that it was schnapps. This would have been highly likely because of the accessibility to fruit that Charles would have had. He could have had his own little still in his cabin. I'm not saying he did, but I will say it was not unusual at that time for crew members to be making their own schnapps or with other ingredients they could make whiskey in a makeshift still in their cabin quarters. Imagine being out at sea for weeks at a time. It would make sense. So he went back downstairs to have a nip. Then he came back upstairs, and as he was getting a drink of water, there were a couple things that happened here in his recollection. He was getting a drink of water, and there was this crashing noise and a sudden rush of people who were going up to the steerage poop deck on steerage. And we see that in the movie as well. I may have jumped ahead there because before that happened, Charles did something really interesting. He saw on the deck, the Titanic deck chairs. You know, there's that expression. People always talk about moving Titanic deck chairs around when they refer to something that's kind of, you know, useless to do. Well, he saw a use in throwing deck chairs overboard so that they were in the water for him if he was able to, if he might be able to hang on to one of them. So he went and threw all these deck chairs in the water. There are only a handful of these deck chairs that have survived. And, you know, there might not be as many if he hadn't done this. But he just thought, if I have to be in that water, because I was not given my assigned spot in lifeboat 10, maybe I can hold on to one of these when I'm in there after the ship has gone under. Apparently they floated, or somewhat at least. Well, you know, we all know what happens. He ends up being part of that big group. Well, those of us that have seen the movie, that is, we know what happens. He was part of that big group rushing the poop deck, and he ends up in the water, and the poor soul tread water for 2 hours. But he said the life preserver was so buoyant, he didn't even get his hair wet. However, that still is not the end of his story. After 2 hours, he spots an overturned collapsible lifeboat with 25 men standing on top, holding each other's shoulders. You imagine standing out there in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and one of the men on board reached out to give his hand to Charles. And it was John Maynard, the entree cook. He recognized him and you know, saw that he was struggling, held his hand. And together, they all said the Lord's Prayer at one point. About 30 minutes after he grabbed John Maynard's hand, they all hear from very nearby in the distance, a man hollered over, "We can only take 10. Charles said to Maynard, "Let go of my hand." And he swam as fast as he could to get over to the lifeboat, where it was mostly women in the lifeboat. He ends up surviving. He gets picked up by that lifeboat, and then the lifeboat gets picked up by Carpathia. And we can see what a lighthearted personality Charles had by the stories he tells. He said he was so frozen that they popped me into the oven like one of my own pies, he said. You know, when he was trying to get warmed up in on the Carpathia. I don't know how much truth there could be to that, obviously, or where that came from. But one of the things that it really shows his personality is the story that he shared to kind of keep things light with his great nieces and nephews. He always told them, "I knew it was an iceberg because I saw a polar bear and it waved at me." So we don't know if that inspired the children's book about the polar bear and the Titanic, but there is a book about the polar bear and the Titanic, which isn't surprising because it seems to all fit together. But that's Charles' story. And he was a remarkable man. He went right back out to sea shortly after this. And it hadn't been his first experience with tragedy like that, with an accident. He had been in other situations as well. So that's why I say I'm inspired by him. And that's why I love his story so much.
That's a great story.
I was going to say, it's a good story too.
Definitely a great story. And then look, that Schnapps made a nice feature in there. So I guess keep Schnapps close by when you're sailing.
When you're sailing? Stop.
That's a great story. And I know there are, you know, obviously numerous other stories. We don't have time to go into all of them, but I know there's a few other stories about passengers. Well, at least one notable one, an Arthur Puchin, who grabbed some oranges instead of stocks or bonds or whatever it was, financial papers and to bring with him when he was fleeing the ship. And then there's a passenger that was on her way to see her betrothed, who owned an 80-acre fruit farm in Oregon. So there are some interesting fresh produce tied stories to the sinking of the ship.
Yeah, John, it's funny. I just got to throw it in there too. My wife, she always asks me, she's like, why do you want to sit in the exit row like of planes? And I do sometimes, depending on which airline I fly for. It's just like Southwest, man. I go right for just like 16 A, B, or C, doesn't matter which one. And a lot of times I'll sit in the exit row, except when I travel with my kids. And she's like, you want to help people when they get off? Like, well, don't you just want to get off? I was like, absolutely, I want to get off. I was like, but I'm a little selfish too. And she's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, one, I want to help the people. I go, but two, I said, I know they say don't grab your backpack, but I want to be last off so I can grab all my stuff. And my wife's like, so you're worried about your stuff? I said, no. I said, I got stuff inside of there that'll help me survive if I'm on a lifeboat, right? Like if I'm the last one on and they're going, okay, you next, I'm gonna go, did you grab all the food? No. All right. Well, let me at least grab my bag because I'm gonna have some oranges in there, some apples, some nuts.
Flask of schnapps.
I'm gonna have stuff in my bag that's gonna help us survive over the next, hopefully, hours, but it could be days. And think about that. Those lifeboats don't come stocked with food. So, I commend some of those people that were grabbing oranges and bread and all these other items outside of their, jewelry or their silver or the heart of the sea as they were looking for with Rose
Right.
in the movie. But think about that. I mean, you're going to be out freezing for days. I mean, you definitely want some calories in your body. So I mean, that's how I always tell my wife. I laugh. It's hopefully it's never going to happen, but I'd be like, yeah, I'm gonna be the guy that's whoever's on my life rope. Like, what'd you do? Like, I grabbed everything. I grabbed all the food. Everybody's got sodas for at least a week, on this thing.
Well, I'll be standing with you if things go down.
Yeah, we'll be the one throwing helping people off as we're sitting
I
there
have
eating
confidence in your
apples.
abilities, but yeah, we know at this point of the story, the Titanic sinks at around 2:20 a.m. on the morning of April 15th, 1912. More than 1,500 souls perish of the total 2,240 passengers and crew. Crazy loss of life. But as we look back on this story, and obviously this is a unique perspective of the story through the lens of produce. Veronica, what would you say is the legacy of Titanic, as it relates to the culinary aspect of the era, or maybe the culinary aspect of dining on the sea? I mean, do we see any ripples or impacts from this specific boat on today, in terms of cruise ships today and things of that nature? Do we see anything that would have impacted or carried through from Titanic onto today?
Well, I think to address the point about cruise ships today, we definitely see that idea of, cruise equals luxury. We don't necessarily see the same distinction, the severity of the distinction or the extent of the distinction. But I think what prevails from this is this really amazing story and this experience, what happened, is the story of these people and understanding the stories of these people through looking at the food and the culinary professionals. And when people, like you mentioned at the beginning here about when the man who said, even God couldn't sink this ship. It was considered or called before it sailed unsinkable. And in many ways, it really was. And that's one of the messages I try to convey in my first book, The Last Night on the Titanic, that in many ways, this really was an unsinkable ship because we are still, talking about it, we're still learning from it, we're still emulating it. I just talked to someone the other day who purchased a bottle of chartreuse for making jelly, things that they learn about that people want to recreate. And it definitely is still very much alive.
That's really well put. Like you say, multiple times throughout this episode, it's really become a time capsule for the period that we might have not have recorded otherwise had this catastrophe have not happened, especially from a culinary standpoint. All these menus and just a real glimpse into that period of time of what people are eating and the significance of what they're eating. So it's definitely a fascinating story. Thank you, Veronica, again for joining us. It's been a real treat to have you on to guide us through this familiar but very sad story at the end of the day. And we can't recommend enough your books to our listeners. There are two of them, The Last Night on the Titanic, and then your latest one, The Titanic, The Official Cookbook, which Patrick was referring to at the beginning of our episode. So definitely look out for those. We'll make sure to put those in our show notes so that our listeners can look to pick those up. But yeah, thank you so much again.
Yeah, Veronica, definitely. Thank you.
Oh, thank you both for what you're doing to share out this really interesting and informative information.
Well, I love what you said. It is an unsinkable ship, because how many years later we are still talking about it. So it is much larger than life than it was if it was probably still around and made that voyage. So again, everyone, thanks for joining us today. John, want to close us out?
Yes, thank you again, everybody, for listening. Thank you again to Veronica. And until next time, it's goodbye for me, John Papp.
And me, Patrick Kelly.